Hi everybody, and those of you online, welcome along to our class. As Deborah said, we're on to class six, the section called How to Meditate. So we'll begin with the meditation ourselves. We'll do a breathing meditation, and I'll set up a visualization for us, and we'll take refuge together. So first of all, just get comfortable in your seat. Just to have your back straight and shoulders relaxed. You can close your eyes or keep them open, whichever seems easier to you. And while you continue to breathe normally and naturally, become aware of the movements that take place in the chest whether you inhale or exhale. While we are breathing normally and naturally, imagine that in the space in front of you appears Shakyamuni Buddha, his body made of golden light, surrounded by your spiritual mentors, the teachers of the different lineages, other Buddhas, meditational deities, bodhisattvas, arahats, and so on. So the vast crowd of people made of light in front of you. We're surrounding you at the level of the ground are all sentient beings. And each of them are experiencing some form of suffering. It could be physical or mental. It may be the suffering of change. But it's most certainly the suffering of all pervasive conditionality. And this is a suffering where the body and mind are not under the person's control. Actually under the control of karma and delusion. And this is the deepest and most subtle form of suffering. It gives rise to the other two forms of suffering, the suffering of change and the suffering of suffering. Now we are all the same in that we do not wish to experience suffering and that we all want to be free of it. Though this is the case, we seem to rush towards suffering and away from the causes of happiness. But this type of behavior can be brought to an end. And we know that because others have actually done it. And those who have put an end to their suffering and got rid of its causes and developed all of their good qualities, but did so depend upon teachings and a spiritual community. So we're going to take refuge in the spiritual community of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas in front of us, the Dharma teachings that they put into practice and realized, and the teacher himself, Shakyamuni Buddha. And like I said, we're doing this to put an end to our own suffering and to help everybody else do the same. So with these ideas in mind, we can recite the refuge prayer together and generate a mind of enlightenment. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. So with this aspiration that we've set forth in front of the refuge field, in response to that, rays of light come up from the Buddha's heart, wash over you and all the beings surrounding you. They remove all the sufferings we experience. However, when we look around us, we see that sentient beings still live in conflict. And this is because they have not yet fully developed the four immeasurable thoughts. So we make a wish that they do so, and with that wish, commit ourselves to helping them do so. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Now again, from the Buddha's heart, rays of light move out through space, covering yourself and all beings. So it awakens the potential that you have to be a fully enlightened being yourself. In response to this, we recite the seven limb prayer. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since the beginning of this time and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own merit to those of all others to the great enlightenment. Now, to remove the most subtle causes of suffering that we have, which are the sort of clinging to different ideas we have, we are going to make an offering of a mandala, a world system, to the refuge field in front of us. So I think that in the absence of the clinging, our body has formed as a basis for this wonderful mandala. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this is what a field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Iram Guru Ratna Mandala Kamayataya. So I've released the mandala. It's accepted by the Buddha and he smiles at us with delight. And as he does so, we gaze into his eyes. And while looking at the Buddha's face, we see that around him, the vast refuge field of the arahats, the bodhisattvas and so forth, has begun to dissolve into light and it melts into the figure of the Buddha. And from the Buddha's heart, an emanation of himself moves through space and comes to abide above the crown of your head, facing in the same direction you are. The emanation descends, entering the crown of your head, coming down, stopping at the level of your heart and beginning to expand with light. Light fills your body and mind, goes out through the pores of your skin and fills all space. And wherever there are beings within space, that you have completely awoken them to their fullest potential. Acknowledge there's no difference between yourself and any being, whether they be fully enlightened beings. Deepest nature is exactly the same. The light begins to draw from the furthest directions of space. Re-entering your heart, you find yourself seated where you are, breathing normally and naturally. You understand that what you've just engaged in is an imaginative process, and it's a sort of a cause for us to actually become fully awakened. But again, just reaffirm your intention for being here. Think that I'm here to develop my potential to its fullest extent, to become a fully awakened being called a Buddha, to help others do the same. And for this purpose, we're at the class learning how to meditate. So now breathing in deeply through your nostrils, exhaling through your mouth, allow your eyes to flutter open, and move your body in whichever way you need to feel comfortable. So we're into class six tonight, which means we've gone through five classes, and this is the material we've covered. We've looked at what meditation is, the different types there are, and its purpose. And we've also looked at stabilizing meditations and also meditations of the imaginative type called visualization. Now, we know when we do this, we meet up with a lot of obstacles. And we've been talking about some of those obstacles, some of them being distraction, excitement, lethargy, laziness. And we also looked at opponents to each of these obstacles. Now, last week, we began by looking at a type of meditation called analytical meditation. And we use the example of impermanence to sort of become familiar with the process of analysis. And as you remember last week, analysis was really based on the reasoning of becoming, you know, placing the mind, which is stable, onto the reason and holding the reason. And the purpose for that is to actually, so we hold reasons, we're sort of holding them conceptually, right, with the mind, with thought. It's a thought. However, this thought, the thought can be sort of turned into or transformed into perception. So you see it directly. So we can do that with emptiness, but also with subtle impermanence. So you can actually know, because it's not, you're not seeing it with your eyes, you're seeing it with your mental capacity. Either that you lack the self you always thought you had, or that phenomena have no substantial existence. As they come into existence, they go out. And that's what we talked about last week. A couple of really important things to always do when you meditate. One is to always set your motivation, and at the end is to always dedicate whatever you do. The middle can always be a bit wonky, but the beginning and end should be good, because it doesn't take a lot to do that, right? You can keep the mind stable there and have a pure intention for doing it. We can know that we've done it, and we can dedicate it. And when we dedicate, try to bring into it the wisdom of emptiness. Understand that everything we've done and that we're dedicating has dependently been accomplished. And it's only in through dependence that we can accomplish our goal. But Buddhahood doesn't exist out there as an entity of some type. We're here in Buddhahood's there, and then we're going to become Buddhas. That's not how it is. So this week we're going to have a look at another analytical topic called Precious Human Rebirth. And I've used these books here. So you can see there's quite a few of them here. There's four, five, there's eight up here. So when I sort of study these topics, I like to, you know, read one author's presentation. I'll go to the next, I try and draw it all together. And what you find is it's not all there in one place. So you find authors focusing on one aspect more than another. And sometimes I'll say things that weren't said before, and you get insight into it. You go like, well, I never knew that. You know, I've never read that before. So I like to find those sort of things and draw them out and introduce them to you. Let's see. So this book here called Lam Rim Year, this only came out this year. And it's very good because the meditations are only like one page long. They've even shortened them up into three lines. So the meditation could be just three lines. There's a meditation for each day of the year. And there's a section here on Fortunate Human Rebirth that's less than a week. It's a very nice, easy way to sort of work your way through it, very brief way. So all of these books have something to offer. Like Waking Up to Your Life has got a whole lot of different ways of looking out to the rarity of the life that you have and so forth. And that's from the sort of Kagyu presentation. Turning Confusion to Clarity is from a Nyingma presentation. All the others are from Galupa.
What's the name of the one with the, is it the Maitreya statue
one? Yep, that one is called The Jewel Staircase. So that's where this book's got all this great reasoning in. So I forgot to bring it up because I wanted to quote from that. So it's such a really great book because the section is not very long, but the author's turned all the teaching into verse from himself. And so I've used a bit of that in this presentation today. Anyway, this one called Gradual Awakening, I've used that one too because, we'll come to the slide, I'll explain why. It's a different presentation again, one that you don't find in any other Buddhist text. Anyway, they've all got something to offer. So we begin with a quote from the Lam Rim Chenmo. So the Lam Rim Chenmo is a great book called, you know, Steps of the Stages of the Path to Enlightenment. And Lama Tsongkhapa is the founder of the Galupa tradition, which is we belong to. So he says, of course, understanding that the precious freedom of this rebirth is found only once is greatly meaningful and difficult to find again. Please listen to generate the mind that unceasingly, day and night, takes its essence. Now, the first thing I should say is this verse cannot be taken literally.
Which bit?
Word once. That's the part you can't take literally. What they're saying is saying it's so rare, this is if it could only take place once. You know, because otherwise it would be like, well, here we are. Is this the once, is it?
But also, isn't there the connotation too that even if we do have another human rebirth, it's not going to be this one? This one is once. This combination of body and mind is once.
Well, that's what I was saying.
Yeah.
And that's not the case. If that were the case, what's the point of doing any meditation and study, is it? It's either enlightenment or nothing. Enlightenment or the lower realms, and you're never going to come out of them. Because so we don't take this literally, right? This little section here. The rebirth with leisure and opportunity, the human rebirth with leisure and opportunity is only found once. That's not true. Not to be taken literally as the truth. What he's saying is very rare and difficult to have it. It's as if it were, you could only get it once. That's what it means. And this last line, to take its essence. So you might think here there's only like essence meaning just one thing. In fact, the essence can be described in three different ways. So this is the type of verse that needs to be unpacked, in other words, which a lot of Buddhist verses do. There's so much in them. So Geshe Sopa says in relationship to this verse, he says there are many different things you can achieve in your life, but so many of them are not essential. So what are the critical goals of a human life? All sentient beings want happiness and do not want suffering. Everyone's primary goal is to be free from every kind of trouble, misery, or suffering. Striving for the goal of true happiness is the essence of a human life. The best situation you can attain is Buddhahood. However, on the way to Buddhahood, there are various levels of religious goals. Using the right methods to reach those goals is the true meaning of extracting the essence from this life. Now, the basis of taking the essence of life is to recognize three things: how special it is, how useful it is, and finally, how suddenly you can lose your life and how difficult it is to obtain such a life again. So I'll say those three again: how special it is, how useful it is, and finally, how suddenly you can lose your life and how difficult it is to obtain such a life again. So the first thing we have to do is to become aware of what we have already achieved, the freedom and good qualities of a human life. Second, you have to contemplate its great value. If you don't care or don't pay attention, you will not see the worth of what you have in your hands. And the third point is to contemplate how difficult it is to obtain such a precious opportunity. Like most valuable things, this type of life is very difficult to obtain again. Now, here's the real thing of it. Essence of it. Realizing these facts will result in a strong inclination to practice. The urge to use your life properly will naturally arise. So that's the goal of this whole, all these meditations. That's what should happen to you. Many years ago, Khyentse Rinpoche, Geshe Tashi Seren gave a teaching on this, and since then I've seen other people use the same example. It's an example of buying a lottery ticket. So you know there are many lottos around the world and you can buy tickets on them. Some of the Americans, they're huge, aren't they? Over 150 million, I saw the last one, fellow won it. So this is like, the analogy is you've bought a ticket and you've discovered that it's the winning ticket. Now, the odds of having the winning ticket in the lottery, like, as you know, they are astronomical, immense.
Once.
Right? And then you think, what can I do with $150 million? Because this ticket is valuable, is it? It has that much value. And then, of course, like I said, the money, you could do so many different things with it. But suppose you had the ticket and just kept it in your pocket. You actually didn't know you'd won. Sorry, Deb? That's right.
And that's happened.
Yeah, people have actually bought tickets and then they've never claimed them. You know, we know that. So this is what this presentation is about. It's like this thing where you find, you're looking, you've got a ticket. You're out to discover whether you've won the lotto. So you go through each of these points and then you might find, my God, I'm a winner. And then it introduces to you to the great value of this win, what you can do with it. And then it points out, look, this is how difficult it was for that to happen. And like, if you don't cash it in, like now, as soon as you can, you might lose it. It's a bit like that as an analogy. The first one I'll introduce you, like, so this is about a fortunate human rebirth. So the human who takes rebirth is a person, aren't they? Yeah. So I want to make sure you understand what is the person. Who's the person that has this rebirth, this wonderful life? So a person, of course, has a mind and a body. And the human being, the unenlightened sentient being, has a mind whose perception and conception are limited. And their body is on a spectrum of pain and pleasure, which is also limited. And the definition of such a person is this. The sentient being, or person, is the I imputed outwardly to any of the four or five aggregates. So this is a definition that's not a common one. You don't often see the term imputed outwardly. So Kensa Rinpoche, our teacher who lives in the city, he introduces extra bitter, which makes it quite interesting and tasty. And oftentimes it just goes to any of the aggregates. But I've also seen it defined as the four or five aggregates. So when it's the five aggregates, it means the body, the physical body, and all the four aggregates of mind. But we know the persons can also take rebirth in the form and formless realms, and there they don't have a physical body. So there's just four aggregates, they're all mental. Now these five aggregates, as you know, are form, which means the physical stuff, our body, and then the next four, feeling, discrimination, compositional factors, and consciousness, those four aggregates make up the mind. As I say, the person is an I imputed outwardly to the body and mind. So what does it mean to be like imputed outwardly? That's right. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, so what's coming outward, thrown outward onto the body, is the name, right? I, person. So if you ask us, who or what is throwing it out? You go, the mind. So what's this mean? So from the point of view of the most subtle of the tenant systems, the middle way consequence point of view, right? It's saying that the person does not exist as an independent, findable entity called self within the body and mind. There's no findable person within the collection of the body and mind, which is their possessor or owner. If there were such a person to exist, what would be the consequence? Can anybody think of a consequence? If the person was existing inside the body and mind, but independent of them and owned them, possessed them, owned them, what would be a consequence of that? What might happen? Ben? Yet they would already be doing that, wouldn't they? Because they are independent of it.
Walk away from the body and the mind.
Now, you could have things happen to the body or the mind and they wouldn't happen to the person. Or you could have something happen to the person and it wouldn't affect the body and mind. That's what it's saying. That's the consequence. If you think you have a self that's in here somewhere and it's the owner, independent of them. Because a farmer is not a farm, are they?
No.
No, right. But the farmer owns the farm, don't they? Yeah? So here we are, we have a body, don't we? We own our body. But we can't find, that's not saying, you know, the farmer is independent of the farm. Right? You can do something to the farm, but it doesn't hurt the farmer. You can do something to the farmer, but it doesn't hurt the farm. But that's not the case for the person, is it? You hurt the body, the person's hurt. You hurt the person, the mind or the body's hurt. So that's what I'm saying. There's no, that's not the person. who's going to have a fortune in the rebirth, right? There's no person like that. Not only are they saying that, he's also saying the person is not one aggregate or any collection of the aggregates, meaning now the person is not the body and they're not the mind. And they're not the body and the mind either. So that's not the person. The person is name only, is imputed, given a name to those things, the collection. That's the person. That's the actual existent person. So we say, how does the person exist? You could say, in name only, dependently imputed upon the aggregates.
So is that why then when we die, that person is finished?
Yes, the person of this life is finished. But a person is still, so that's how you get person goes on. But the person of this life, Deb, Eddie, they're dead. That doesn't go on. They're dead. They're finished. They don't have another life. But the I that was once called Eddie, that goes on. Yep. So Bender said, so it's the middle way between a complete annihilation where Ben just dies and it's all over. There's nothing else. Or there's an actual Ben that goes on.
Well, there's a Ben that keeps on going. Being from life to life to life.
Yeah.
Thank goodness there's not a Ben from life to life to life. Oh, my God, that would be tedious.
Those two, they're not the person that goes on. They're not the person that has a precious human rebirth. The person that actually has a precious human rebirth is the mere person. So this mere person is exhorted to take advantage of having a human rebirth with leisure and opportunity. And that's our topic. But I wanted to bring it to you first of all to make sure you know who the person is here. It's easy to forget. It's easy to identify yourself with the body.
Yeah, well, usually if we're sick, we identify ourselves with the body.
With the body, isn't it? Yeah. So there is an exhortation. So exhortation basically is a process of urging or encouraging or persuading. So this topic is called an exhortation on the preciousness of this human life. So in other words, it's urging us to first of all discover what it is to have a precious human life and then to take advantage of the opportunity while you've got them. And so what makes up this meditation topic is it's got three aspects. So the first aspect is to first of all identify what this precious human rebirth is. What is that? And as somebody who has the leisure as a human being, here we go. So it's looked at in a number of ways. So we look at leisure and then we look at opportunity. And when we look at the leisure side, we're looking at
time.
It's called freedom. And what it looks at first of all is the things is that what is not the precious human rebirth? What hinders? What stops it? And as you go through it, you'll see, from the human aspect, it's these things. And you look at yourself and go, well, are those things hindering me? And you might find, no, I don't have that problem. I don't have that problem either. I don't have that one. So that's what's sort of called freedom. But they do it from the point of view of being imprisoned in a way. And you ask yourself, well, have I got those problems? And you say, no, yeah, good. The last thing is that there are states of existence which are not human. But the I, the person, could find themselves experiencing that. So that's why I'm trying to start off at the beginning with the I being imputed. So we first of all identify the human who has leisure and opportunity. And then we look at the great importance of having it, and we can see that it has a value of a temporary nature, a momentary nature, and the ultimate nature. Then the last thing is this difficulty, right? So then we look at the rarity and the causes, analogies, and numbers. And finally, that we have these other elements, which are focused around the need to meditate on this topic. Not only the need to, but it's quite possible for us to do it, and we should do it. That's how it's set out in the books. When you meditate on it, it's not like that. It's done differently.
So this is the checklist.
Yeah, so when you meditate on it, you start on the rarity of it. Then you come to identifying what it is, and then you come to the great importance of what you can actually do with it. So just I want to bring it to your attention, something to be aware of is if you don't know, sometimes I'll meditate, I'll start to meditate on the material. You start just going through as it's presented in the book, but it won't bring you the realizations because the order is different. Right? If you change the order, suddenly you get, oh my God. So this I found this very true in terms of the rarity. You start with the rarity, you're going to get a big shock straight off, and you go, oh my God, who I am in the big picture. It's just remarkable. Right? So you want to sort of get that happen to you. So this teaching is the first practice for beginners, and it produces a motivation to accomplish the Dharma, to realize it. Miles Neal from Gradual Awakening says, the contemplation on the preciousness of this form of human life, it's a certain form, it's a rare and precious. It's not every human life, it's a special type of life. So the contemplation on the preciousness of this form of human life is a reflection on gratitude that allows us to appreciate that we have everything we need now to liberate ourselves. Just like I say, this is like having the ticket. If you don't cash it, you don't get the reward. And the lovely thing in that book, Dual Staircase, is there's a whole section on there of what prevents you from cashing it in, which I've never seen in other Lam Rim texts. And so it's like, whoa, give it a bit of a shock. You know, so some of the things I think are really important about this topic is to know what's the point of doing it? Why are we benefiting? What should result if we are successful in this? And like I said, a sense of gratitude, a sense of like wonder and sort of richness too. Like, my God, like I've got it. Like I said, I've got the ticket. I'm the winner. And you can look around and see so many losers. So I'm not saying in a derogatory sense, is that they don't have the winning ticket. There's only one winner in the lotto.
Yeah, so if we're just like too lazy to cash it, there's a whole lot of people that are going to be going, what are you thinking?
Okay, so let's go on. So Arya Nagarjuna says in a letter to a friend, to be reborn with false beliefs, or yet as animals or ghosts or in hell, deprived of Buddha's words, barbarians and borderlands, or reborn dull and dumb, or born among the long-lived gods. Of these eight defective states that give no opportunity, you must be free. And finding opportunity, be diligent to put a stop to birth. So what's in this quote here is the eight unfavorable states. And if you find you are not within those eight states, you have the freedom. Now you have leisure. But so I'm going to mention the first four, which are rebirth and non-human states. So we are already victorious. We have got four of the numbers in the lotto. Because we are not animals at the moment. We're not hungry ghosts. We're not long-lived gods, and we're not in hell. Because if you find yourself reborn there, you do not have the opportunities to attain enlightenment while you're there. It's very, very, very difficult. Basically, you have to die and be reborn again and hopefully come to a higher state like the one we've got now before you can engage. So it's very hard for beings in the hellish states because they face intense physical torment. So hell beings are unable to direct their minds to spiritual practice. So I know it's probably very hard to believe in hell realms and hungry ghost realms and all that. That's okay, because the next slide is a different presentation of the same thing, and you might be able to get your head around that much easier. But the hell, like I said, the hell beings, the torment is just so great you cannot turn your mind to the Dharma. So you might have found yourself in this life having a migraine headache that is just so intense, you cannot think anything other than to deal with this pain. So it's like that, except worse. The hungry ghosts are distracted from spiritual practice by extreme hunger and thirst, as well as by their constant search for food and drink and the frustration of not being able to procure them. Third, animals are eaten by other animals, which are higher on the food chain. They're often mistreated by humans and are mentally incapable of understanding Dharma teachings. And lastly, those born in these god realms, that they call the discriminationless gods. They are a type of god in the fourth form realm, have almost no mental activity during that life. Born there because of having cultivated the meditative absorption without discriminations in the previous life, their only moments of clear discrimination occur at the time of their birth and death. And it's even said that the suffering there is worse than the sufferings of the hell beings. That only happens once, when they know where they're going to go when they die. So we've mentioned some of these realms before in our previous classes, right? In terms of these form and formless realms. So like I said, there's states where one of them is just, there's no thinking whatsoever. You just sort of blissed out. No conception. You're alive, of course. So let's have a look now. It's the same topic, right? Rebirth in a hell state. So this means not being born tormented, schizophrenic, or delusional. And this is traditionally called a hell being in Tibetan Buddhist cosmology. So you know there are human beings born like that, don't we? Are you one of them?
Me?
Delusional. Well, so it's being born tormented, schizophrenic. Yeah. Now, we know not every baby born to a human being comes out fine, don't we? So I suggest we all come out fine. So we've got five. We have three and five ways. The sixth one is a hungry ghost, not being born or compelled by severe addiction. So look at us. No. We also know that, I mean, I think it was the 80s, 70s, 80s, must have been 80s, 90s. In America, they were the birth of all those crack babies. So mothers are alcohol, you know, all sorts of things can impact the human birth, can't they?
That's right. They were born as addicts and also without any dopamine, so no physical basis to be able to experience happiness.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's happened. So we're not those people. As an animal, not being born severely anxious or preoccupied with securing basic needs for survival. Lastly, as a long life god, not being born pathologically narcissistic and self-absorbed in one's fame, power, or privilege. So these ways of describing the lower states have been translated using the language of clinical psychology. And that's why I really like that book. Because that, for me, resonates much more stronger than the other presentation.
And Dante's Inferno.
Yeah, that's right. Now, just no way we can know that, isn't it? We just have to sort of believe it. Because one of them, he likes it. I said, I wasn't born as an addict, but I was compelled as an addict to do lots of silly things. And I never met the Dharma while I was like that. It was only when I stopped that I was able to find the Dharma. So you can find, so one of the advices, if you don't have a fortunate human rebirth, get one. Yep, this is right. So once again, that's right.
That's right. As a woman in poverty in a third world country, living as if you're an animal, as if you're a dog.
Yep. Yep. That's right.
We're back on?
Yep, you're back on. That's right.
The ticket's back in the pocket.
Yeah, yeah. That's right. But you can imagine that being so, like, if you weren't,
yeah.
Right. Suddenly, then suddenly, it'd be very difficult, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
And that's what it's sort of saying here, that if you don't have this type of rebirth, it's very difficult. It's not saying it's impossible. It's saying it's very difficult, very difficult, much more difficult than someone who had a perfect rebirth. That's what it's saying. And here is just this the eight freedoms. Because not only do we need to be free of these sins, we also need conditions that support it. So just having the eight freedoms is not having a perfect human rebirth. It's the first part of it. But if you found yourself, like I said, look around, there are animals around the place. Very hard for an animal to become liberated, wouldn't it be? Very hard for them to practice, you know, to read, or you know, for us to impart Dharma to them, to hear it and go, I know what to do.
Animals come to all the teachings on Zoom, and it's, you know, they don't get as much benefit out of it as we do.
Yeah, no, while you're in it, you can't change it. The only thing that can help you is your death.
Yeah.
You to die and new rebirth. That's right. Some of those things.
We can change those.
That's right. That's their right.
Yeah. But when you're in those psychological states, it's really difficult to change them.
Yeah.
You have to wait until they come to the natural end, or you can find some medication, or you get some help. But actually meeting the Dharma in those states is really...
Yeah, it doesn't won't do a great deal for you. So Dharma can be there, but you need help. So this is... when you find yourself, you know, like free here, so then you have the eight freedoms. And that's great. But you still need assistance of more conditions, which leads us to the next part. So the next six is called, I've only done the four. They're here in the human conditions, right? So there are also four there. So we looked at the four of the non-human. Now we're looking at the four human conditions. So if you are a human being and a Buddha has not appeared, you don't have a perfect human rebirth. And so for many people, like in Africa, perhaps in the furthest reaches of Canada, you know, for them, the Buddha has not appeared. Buddha may have appeared, but they had no way to relate to him. And so they have no introduction to the next one, I think, the Dharma. And so you need a teacher, we need teaching.
Yeah, so if the Dharma is not translated into your language.
Which doesn't help either. Now, if you have defective senses, if you are blind, deaf, it's hard.
In a wheelchair,
that's right. You know, there's lots of problems once you have defective senses. That's just a fact. It's not saying you can't engage in Dharma, because Biffy's got a really good friend who is blind. And as we know, this material has been transformed into Braille, and you can have it on audiobooks and so forth. It's a bit more easier now. But that's only for like very few people, isn't it? You add up all the people in the world, you're not going to find everybody's got access to audiobooks or Braille.
You need to have the resources.
That's right. Yeah.
And then even if you do, then it takes twice as long to get to a Dharma centre, and all the life maintenance takes twice as long.
And lastly, this wrong views. You know, so the wrong view could just be, oh, this idea about Buddha's up, bull dust, no such thing, and nirvana, ha, ha, ha. You know, karma, what's that? No, karma doesn't exist.
That's like being, if you're a headstrong materialist,
that's right.
There's no way forward.
Yeah. So the fourth one is instinctively holding wrong views. You've got to hold them. I mean, we can easily have one, but are you going to hold it? And so this is another one. If you hold a wrong view, you could be persuaded to drop it. So instinctively holding wrong views, making our mind unreceptive to examining new explanations of dukkha, its cause, the cessation, and the path leading to that cessation. In other words, being free from disempowering beliefs in an omnipotent creator controlling one's fate, or nihilism, believing that life is meaningless. There's plenty of people that think that. Others think, you know, there's a God creator sort of thing. It's in his hands, these sort of ideas. So as Holiness says, when you meditate on these eight unfavorable conditions, do not simply think of other people born in those states. Instead, imagine living in those circumstances yourself. Then recall your current freedom from those limitations and appreciate the excellent conditions you now have. So, you know, I'd look at this and go, well, I'm pretty sure all of us here meet the criteria. We have the eight freedoms. So to have the eight freedoms means you have the leisure to engage in the study of Dharma. That's the freedom you have, leisure. And that's what the word freedom means here, leisure. Whereas if you think about it, if you didn't have, it wouldn't be such a leisurely process, would it? So these are the eight freedoms. Now we come to the 10 richnesses, or what they call the 10 endowments, or the 10 opportunities. Arya Sangha said, born human in a central land with complete sense faculties, not having committed the extreme actions, faith in the objects. When Buddha has appeared and taught the Dharma remains and is followed, and people have love for others. So there are 10, what we call the 10 endowments, or the 10 opportunities, the 10 richnesses, the 10... They're divided into two lots, 5 that are personal and 5 that are circumstantial. The 5 that are personal are, you are a human being. Tick again, that's 9. You are born in the centre of a religious country. That means you are in a country where religion is allowed. There is the religion, in particular, the Buddhism is here, which it is. You have all the faculties of body and mind, and they function. You haven't committed any of the 5 heinous actions. 5 heinous actions are to have killed your mother or father in the slough, to have deliberately harmed, tried to kill a Buddha, harmed an arahat, and tried to break a spiritual community apart. Pali tradition, yeah, it can't be done, but the Pali tradition is not aiming for Buddhahood. All of these can be overcome through the purification practice. Yes, I met a young man actually who killed his parents, mother and father. And I know, like he asked for Pende to come and see. Pende's a Buddhist monk. But this fellow, it meant actually, you know, acknowledging that and your reasons for doing so and being, having remorse for doing so and those sort of things. But actually, he was very pleased. He was glad to have killed his parents. He was really upset with them, you know. So it would have taken, so for that fellow, very, you know, that's a problem right there. Could be overcome in time. And so this is what they're sort of saying, if you don't have them, get them. And so these are the 5 personal things that relate to yourself, but here we need things from society, the environment. So 5 conditions coming up.
So faith in the Dharma, just to go over that. So that meaning an interest in the Dharma, or?
So when you say faith in the Dharma, we're looking at belief, the practice of ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom. So you've got to have some sort of thing that the faith that you reap what you sow. Actions have consequences.
It's like an understanding of karma.
Yeah, an understanding of, you sort of have to, having belief in things worthy of respect, such as the Vinaya, which is the basis of all Dharma, which is the ethical stuff. 3 baskets of teachings on ethical conduct, concentration, and wisdom, and so forth. So a Buddha has appeared. Buddha has taught. The Dharma has not been generated because we still have people interested in, we still have ordained Sangha, and there's some teachings going on. It is possible to meet pure followers of the Dharma. And finally, practitioners still do enjoy kind support. It's still going on in our world. So, this, like I said before, if you don't have all 18, you don't have the rare and precious human rebirth. So then, like the teacher says, then get them. And if you can't, you just have to accept that, okay, in this life, it would be impossible for me to achieve perhaps Buddhahood. Liberation. But then you might ask, there's another, as I said, the essence is divided into 3. Buddhahood, liberation, rebirth as a human being with leisure and opportunity to try again. You might not have it now, but you can still practice ethics in this life. You can still practice generosity. And you can wish to have a life of leisure and opportunity. And that's what you have to, that's what we need to do now, us people who have these 18 endowments. So whether you've got them or not, you have to, that's the thing, to get them. That's how you get them.
But because we're in such fortunate circumstances now, even if we don't have all of them now, there is a workaround. We've got so many workarounds available to us.
Yeah, for most people. But like I was saying, for some they don't. But there's no workaround. So you go, okay, so you don't have one now. If you're a human being and you know of this, do you have any faith in this? Do you have any interest in this? Well, if you don't, well then, you know, sort of bad luck, isn't it? But suppose you didn't have interest in it. And you found that you're blind or deaf or you had some other problem. Maybe you're a drug addict right now, but it seemed to make sense to you. Or like you might have schizophrenia problems. If you really analyze, go, look, I'm not going to get enlightened. I doubt if I'll be liberated. Can I make sure I at least have a rebirth once again to have another shot at it? And the answer, you know, you could. So it's not like, you know, it's all over. It's not fatalistic. The Shanti Davis says, so hard to find such ease and wealth, whereby to render meaningful this human rebirth, this human birth. If I now fail to turn it to my profit, how could such a chance be mine again? It's like saying, I've got the 150 million lotto ticket and I'll just get by another ticket. Maybe I'll get it again.
No, but we've got to have leisure to be able to study. Like, that's, time, yeah. That's what I thought, it's time. Yeah. If you've got no spare time, if you just, like, go to work and look after the family and have no time, you've got no leisure. Mm. Where are the leisure classes?
So we've got to take advantage of it. And this leads us to, like, how important it is, because we can bring about these three goals. We can achieve the ultimate goal, temporary goals, and momentary goals. So the ultimate value of having a human life at leisure and opportunity is, of course, enlightenment. With the five aggregates of such a rebirth, body and mind of a human being, with the leisure and opportunity, we can gain the ultimate goals of liberation and enlightenment. So it's said in the text I read today, when the gods die in the other realms, the other gods make a prayer, wish for them, may you be born in the human realm. Because it's only in the human realm you can become enlightened in your lifetime. And that's not just because of the mind, it's because of the body you have. But it's only with this body that you could engage in the Ayashoga tantric practices and become enlightened in this life. There's no other body that you can do that with. Its temporary value, of course, is to be able to discern the differences between ordinary and authentic happiness and act accordingly. So in other words, you can discern the difference between hedonic and authentic sources of happiness. So in other words, so that we've come along to Buddhist classes. Before we came here, we thought the sources of our happiness depended upon our senses. We found that that's not true. That's not the case. Doesn't matter how much beauty, goodness, whatever it is, we've drawn in through our senses, it's never been enough. In fact, all we've done is wanted more. So that doesn't work. Yet as a human being, we can know that it doesn't work. And then we get introduced to, that's called the hedonic treadmill. There's another way of being happy. It's through basically using your mind. The Greeks did it. The Romans did it. So many other cultures have done it. We can do it too. In this life, we can know what actually harms us, what actually is of benefit. We can find out what is an actual cause to produce the happiness, what actually produces suffering. You know, so one of the things we probably weren't ever aware of that produces suffering is a sense that to neglect others. In fact, our government suggests we keep neglecting others. That's a good thing to do so, and we should all do it. We should be just looking after ourselves. So a lot of people go along with that. But that's not a source of happiness. So we can find that out, you know, in this life. So that's why this life's very useful as a temporary basis to discover what works and what doesn't, to abandon what does not work, adopt what does, and engage in a path. Then there's momentary value. That means value at every moment. So we can realize first that it's our attitudes that are the final arbiters. This phenomenon that we call reality is mind dependent. There's no reality independent of the mind. Reality depends on mind. What you bring is what you get. Also, the quality of life is not to be found in any external thing. We're sort of creators of the qualities. We discover them, we name them, we experience them. They're not out there independent of the mind. We can make this life truly meaningful from moment to moment. We can even miss a few moments and then catch up the next one. It's always possible. Like we often say, so you make a mistake, it's okay, start again. So Lama Zopa Rinpoche says, what is so rare and precious about having a human life with leisure and opportunity is to have favorable conditions and the spare time to develop your mind through the study and practice of Dharma. So the spare time is the leisure. And we have the conditions. And I was saying to Miffy, you know, before I came to Australia, the conditions weren't there in New Zealand. The year I left, Lama Zopa and Lama Yeshe arrived in New Zealand. Missed him. Yeah, that's right. I had no idea. Lumbee Tukma Centre was just down the road from where I lived in Red Hill. It was just a walk down. And then when I met Penday, he said, oh, I'll take you to the Buddhist Centre. I said, oh, my God, it's so close. It's all downhill. Yes, yeah, so it's, you know, it's sort of miraculous in many ways, isn't it? So Shantri Davis is thus, having found this moment of reprieve, if I now fail to train myself in virtue, what greater folly could there ever be? How more could I betray myself? So if you know, in other words, he's sort of saying, look, now that you know what brings about happiness, what causes happiness, and now that you know there's an ultimate form of happiness, a type of happiness that doesn't disintegrate and change into suffering. Now that you know what actually causes suffering. Now, if you don't, he's sort of saying, if you don't apply this knowledge, I don't think you could betray yourself any more deeply. In fact, in Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, I really like this quote too. I remember when Geshe first read, I just cracked up. He says, more stupid yet, than one who throws some slops into a golden vessel all bejeweled is he who's gained a precious human life and wastes it in an evil, sinful life. But yeah, so my mind, I just saw beautiful bars with all these jewels on them and someone just doing caca in it. And going, there you go. And you go, that's what your life is like, right? The jewels are your senses. They're bringing all these beautiful things. And what do? Think terribly. Don't know how to use your mind about it. Fill yourself with garbage. I mean, plenty of people are doing it. And when I heard this, I went, that's fire out, that's me. Okay, so now we come to this last section, and it's called the great difficulty. And the great difficulty here is around three things, the numbers, the causes, and analogies to demonstrate these two. So I really love this picture because anyone who's tried to row across the field knows how difficult it is.
Just rowing in itself is pretty.
That's right.
Let alone it will not go round.
Yeah. So in terms of numbers, what we're really talking about here is the evolutionary timescale. In terms of causes, we're looking at morality, generosity, and aspirational prayer. And in terms of analogy, there's lots of them. Some of them are the dried lentils sticking to a new and smooth wall. So if you've ever picked up those dried lentils or dried peas, and like it's just sitting here throwing up against the wall and expecting one to stick on the wall. So having a rebirth and so forth, it's even more difficult than that. To have mustard seeds, and you get a needle and put up like that and drop mustard seeds down like that and expect one of them to stand to hit that tip and stay there. Having a fortunate rebirth is rarer than that. But the one we're going to use is the example of the tortoise going at the bottom of the ocean. So let's have a look at the numbers. And this is the one that really got me when I did it through. So the effect of achieving. So this stuff is really about the effects, and the next one's about the causes. So the effect of achieving a human life with a leisure and opportunity to engage in the study of Dharma is exceedingly difficult to achieve. So anybody here know how old the universe is? It's about 14 billion years old. And you're still not sure, it could be even older. 14 billion years old. And the size of the universe is 93 billion light years across. So how long is a light year? 9.5 trillion kilometers. So it's 9.5 trillion multiplied by 93 billion. That's how large the universe is. That's right.
That's just our universe.
That's the universe. That's right. Yeah. Okay. So within this universe, we have the Earth, right? The Earth is estimated to be about 4.5 billion years old, plus or minus 50 million years. Current estimates for the number of species on Earth range between 5.3 million and 1 trillion. We're the humans. We're a species. A trillion, which is 1,000. Oh, wow, that's millions. 1,000 billions. Right? That's massive. Right? Now, the first humans, so that's the first humans appeared on the Earth between 5 million and 7 million years ago. Humans make up 0.01% of the life on Earth. Life expectancy in 2010 in general, 67 years. So you like start here and you start going back up here and like you're less than a blink in anything, right? In fact, there's a great, I remember the study that they put all this together in a picture. Yeah? And the human being, like us, was the last edge on the toenail of the person. The whole person itself is like the universe. You do all the other things and we're the final edge on your toenail.
And by we are, you mean all humanity, human beings.
Yeah. So that's just... Yeah, the human beings. Yeah. Then, so that's in terms of these. So these numbers, this is what they call a kalpa, right? So these universes I've just been talking about, so large and so forth, they last for a period of time, then they go out of existence. Then new ones come back in. And Buddhas are only there, the Buddhas that teach are only there for a very short period of time. They're not there all the time. Because to be there and to appear to those sentient creatures have to be, the cause and conditions have to be in place. There's no good a Buddha there teaching when nobody can take the teachings. So that's cause and effect. That's not going to happen.
So all of evolution has to happen.
That's right.
To end up, to actually have beings that can listen to the Dharma.
And within, like I said, all these beings, right, I said before, there's like 1 trillion just on Earth, right, on this planet Earth. Well, as you know, so in Buddhism, they also talk about the hell realm beings, right, the hungry ghosts. They're not on Earth. They live elsewhere. So you've got all these massive amount of beings, right? So there's this lovely little story. This is from a book called The Basis of Discipline. That the number of beings dying in the lower, dying from the higher realms and being born in the lower realms is as great as the dust on this earth. Whereas the beings born from the lower realms into the human realms is like the dust on your fingernail. That's how rare it is. So it's very, very, very rare. Now, the thing is, why? So, yeah, so we have this sort of thing here in terms of the time and space and all that sort of stuff, right? So I sort of like that because it makes the insignificance of your life as a human being, like right now while you're living, so infinitesimal, isn't it? It's sort of like a miracle.
Well, that's what Ricochet says often, that seems impossible, yet it happened.
Yeah, but here we are. It's really, really hard to happen because the causes that produce it are really, really difficult to come together. And these, you know, basically, like I said, morality, generosity, and dedication. So His Holiness says, if endowment as a human could be attained again and again over the course of lifetimes, it wouldn't be so bad if we didn't use it now and waste it. However, life as a human is rare. So just us, you know, just use the numbers. What we know of science tells you it's very, very rare. 0.01% in terms of the life on Earth. And we're one of a trillion. Why is human life rare? Well, all impermanent phenomena are dependent upon causes and conditions. And this human physical life support system that is potentially so effective requires high quality causes. What are those causes? A human lifetime requires pure moral activity in a former life. We've done it. It's happened. It's obviously been done because here we are. We have to do it again. Beyond this, a human lifetime during which transformative practice can be achieved requires prior engagement in virtues, such as charity and patience. And these virtuous acts themselves need to be consciously aimed toward attaining the time and the qualities needed for religious practice. With this motivation, these acts will not be wasted by having their karmic results take place in a lifetime as a very intelligent animal living with the queen, for instance.
The
corgis. Yeah. Thus, three factors are needed to become a highly endowed human: fundamental moral behavior, practicing generosity and the like, meaning patience, other things like that, and dedication of these practices towards bearing fruition in a human lifetime. Now, this line here, bearing fruition in a human lifetime, don't aim it at that, aim it at enlightenment. Enlightenment is the real big one. It covers. That virtue is much, much greater than a human lifetime. It's the big one. You want to go for the big one. So even, you know, we always do this, don't we? We dedicate towards enlightenment because we know if we don't, we'll hit human rebirth. Because enlightenment depends upon human rebirth. There's the causal relationship there. And so don't just aim for the small one, like aim for the big one.
Which is something that we can often think, I'll just cut my losses, I doubt I'll be able to come in life and I won't bother dedicating that way, which is...
Yeah, you see this a lot in our food design. I'm listening to this. Oh my God, make that big dedication. What's wrong with you?
Courage.
Maybe lack of courage, maybe just a little bit embarrassed. Shy, maybe.
But
because yeah.
Matthew Ricard talks about this is the ultimate ambition. This is a positive ambition. It's not distorted, and we've got to have it. We've got to have to be part of this and this. Huge ambition to become a Buddha.
So, yeah, the other thing that makes it very difficult, of course, is for most of us until we come to Buddhist classes, we don't know that actions are made up of four parts. And so when we do bad actions, we nearly always do the four parts unconsciously, but they're always carried out. When we're the virtuous, we don't do all four parts. So every virtue is very weak, but every non-virtue is very strong. And so we've got to sort of reverse that process, right? That's why, you know, we always start off, we dedicate, you know, we motivate first of all. We go, right, that's the most important thing. That takes care of the negative karma, the positive intention. Now I've just got to make sure that the last three parts are correct. Anyway, so causes are very difficult to bring together. And these analogies, so here's the analogy of the turtle in Nagarjuna says, for an animal to obtain birth as a human being is more difficult than for a blind turtle to put its head through a hole in a yoke adrift in the great ocean. So make your life meaningful, O King, by practicing the holy teachings. So in this metaphor, the vast ocean is samsara, and sentient beings are the turtle. So most sentient beings, like this turtle, are blinded by ignorance. They do not understand cause and effect and cannot distinguish virtuous from non-virtuous karma. Most of these sentient beings live in the lower realms, at the bottom of the ocean of samsara. The turtle coming up to the surface once every 100 years represents the very rare chance for a sentient being to be born as a human being or a god. But even more rare than that is the turtle poking its head through the center of the golden yoke. The golden yoke represents the Buddha's teachings, especially the complete highest Mahayana teaching, which includes both Sutra and Tantra. And that's what this metaphor in brief means. So Arya Shanti Davis says, relying on the boat of a human body, free yourself from the great river of pain. As it is hard to find this boat again, this is no time for sleeping. For those who have to really develop a clear recognition of the value of the life that we have, acknowledge the tremendous potential that this life has to achieve both temporal and ultimate goals, and start rowing. Yeah. So to cultivate our, this is how this material is presented in the text. Like I said, when you actually meditate, you actually start off from the solar one of going, here I am in this universe. It's just, start narrowing it down. So yes, it seems I'm very, very insignificant. But lo and behold, I'm a human being. Not only that, I've got these 8 freedoms and I've got the 10 conditions. My God. Yeah. Well, so once you do this and you look outside, you go, how many people do you think in the street know about karma, rebirth, how the eye, how phenomena exists? Very, very few. Even us here have difficulty understanding it. We might have heard it. It's difficult to understand. It's even harder to put into practice. But this is what was mentioned in this book. You know, even though you can have it, you can still lose. You lose the potential. Find yourself, in this life, you're not reborn as a human being. And Kensa Rinpoche said, which I've never forgotten, if you find yourself after your rebirth not as a human being, understand you've blown it. You've wasted your life. So we should cultivate our understanding. And that's, like I said, acknowledging that we are in a very fortunate situation. We are free from a lot of obstacles that other people meet, and that's very rare. To attain the same opportunity in another life, the next life, we must be moral beings, ethical people. The most important form of ethics you can practice is to die with a virtuous mind. If you don't do that, you missed it. That's where you're going to find yourself a lot of trouble afterwards. But it's that virtuous mind, the time of death, that's the karma. We want that to push us off into the right direction. Okay, if that's not there, we're in great trouble. And whenever we create these virtuous acts, we should try and always do them with a good motivation. You know, like we know the activity of thought, speech, bodily actions, made up of parts. Actions have parts. The most important part is having the motive for the thought, the motive for the speech, the motive for the act. So we need to think, like the soul is saying, day and night, try to make good use of this body of yours. which, although it's a home of illness and the basis for the sufferings of old age, still get us through out of it. So I like this. The Rinpoche says this: you have this precious human body qualified by the 8 freedoms and the 10 riches in order to serve other living beings. And that's the point of having this life. Nice and simple, but I remember reading this when I read it, like I said, I nearly fell off my chair. It was like so like obvious, but shockingly obvious. It's like, you know, got eyelashes and I can't see them. And this is the purpose, help one another.
But it's good to have it spelt out.
Yeah, betcha. That's right. It has to be spelt out and considered often, thought about often. Yeah? Contrasted against just working for your own welfare. See what the difference is. So in brief, we've looked at this fortunate human rebirth, meaning of the leisure and opportunities to engage in a spiritual practice. And I said to become familiar with it, that we analyze the situation. That's what this has been, an analytical meditation, something you think about. And in the conclusion of all this thinking is a sense of gratitude that you have this life with the opportunities to engage in the practice. Whereas a lot of people and no animals, all the other, the trillion minus one, don't have that chance. Out of all the living beings, we're one in a trillion. And in that one, the human beings, not every human being is engaged in spiritual practice. If you find you are, that's incredibly rare and precious and should be kept up as incredibly valuable.
So it should also give us a whole lot of confidence too, because even though this path can be quite overwhelming and enormous, the fact that we are here shows we've already done a great deal.
That's right.
The capability, there's the proof.
Yeah, this life that we have is the proof that it can be done. We're not enlightened, we're not liberated, but we've done the first part. We've taken the first essential aspect of having a life of leisure and opportunity. It's been done.
And right? Actually, then we'll get so many said, you know, in terms of the Bodhisattva path and 3 countless great eons, to not get kind of demoralized about that, because we're right at the end of that. It's like we're almost there. We're not at the beginning of it. Because look where we are. We're well ahead.
Okay, so for next week, have a look at these things on the supplementary readings, reads pages 7 to 12 and pages 16 to 17. Both of them are about fortunate human rebirth. And there's a meditation in the meditation sections on pages 10 to 11. And next week, we'll have a look at the topic of equanimity. So I wanted to put it in this order, of course, that the FPMT have suggested a number of different analytical topics. I put this one in because when I read about D. Allen Wallace's study and meditative engagement in the past, when he went to Dharamsala, his first teacher, the first meditations he got to do were fortunate human rebirth and equanimity. And his teacher said, put them together. One day on this, next day on this, one day on that, next day on that. They do this, they would do the same here, see what the benefit is. So I want to just say thank you very much for giving me a chance to impart the Buddha's teachings once again. So I'm very grateful you're here and I can make my life meaningful and valuable. It certainly wasn't before I came here. So we've created some merit. So I want to dedicate that merit, which exists in mere name, towards the goal of enlightenment, which also exists in mere name. That we attain that enlightenment for the benefit of all sentient beings, which just like dreams and illusions, but dependently in name.